lived, watch Ashley's face to her heart's content. It was only Ashley who drew her to the house, for the conversations bored and saddened her. They always followed a set pattern, first hard times, next the political situation, and then, inevitably, the war. The ladies bewailed the high prices of everything and asked the gentlemen if they thought good times would ever come back. And the omniscient gentlemen always said, indeed they would. Merely a matter of time. Hard times were just temporary. The ladies knew the gentlemen were lying, and the gentlemen knew the ladies knew they were lying. But they lied cheerfully, just the same. And the ladies pretended to believe them. Everyone knew hard times were here to stay. Once the hard times were disposed of, the ladies spoke of the increasing impudence of the Negroes, and the outrages of the carpetbaggers, and the humiliation of having the Yankee soldiers loafing on every corner. Did the gentlemen think the Yankees would ever get through with reconstructing Georgia? The reassuring gentlemen thought reconstruction would be over in no time. That is, just as soon as the Democrats could vote again. The ladies were considerate enough not to ask when this would be. And having finished with politics, the talk about the war began. Whenever two former Confederates met anywhere, there was never but one topic of conversation, and where a dozen or more gathered together, it was a foregone conclusion that the war would be spiritedly refought. And always the word "if" had the most prominent part in the talk. If England had recognized us, if Jeff Davis had commandeered all the cotton and gotten it to England before the blockade tightened, if Longstreet had obeyed orders at Gettysburg, if Jeb Stuart hadn't been away on that raid when Marse Bob needed him, if we hadn't lost Stonewall Jackson, if Vicksburg hadn't fallen, if we could have held on another year, and always, if they hadn't replaced Johnston with Hood, or if they put Hood in command at Dalton instead of Johnston, if... The soft, drawling voices quickened with an old excitement as they talked in the quiet darkness. Infantryman, cavalryman, cannoneer, evoking memories of the days when life was ever at high tide, recalling the fierce heat of their midsummer and this forlorn sunset of their winter. They don't talk of anything else, thought Scarlet. Nothing but the war, always the war. And they'll never talk of anything but the war. No, not until they die. She looked about, seeing little boys lying in the crooks of their father's arms, breath coming fast, eyes glowing, as they heard of midnight sorties and wild cavalry dashes and flags planted on enemy breastworks. They were hearing drums and bugles and the rebel yell, seeing footsore men going by in the rain with torn flags slanting. And these children will never talk of anything else either. They'll think it was wonderful and glorious to fight the Yankees and come home blind and crippled, or not come home at all. They all like to remember the war, to talk about it. But I don't. I don't even like to think about it. I'd forget it all if I could. Oh, if I only could. She listened with flesh crawling as Melanie told tales of Tara, making Scarlet a heroine as she faced the invaders and saved Charles's sword, bragging how Scarlet had put out the fire. Scarlet took no pleasure or pride in the memory of these things. She didn't want to think of them at all. Oh, why can't they forget? Why can't they look forward and not back? We were fools to fight that war, and the sooner we forget it, the better we'll be. But no one wanted to forget. No one, it seemed, except herself. So Scarlet was glad when she could truthfully tell Melanie that she was embarrassed at appearing, even in the darkness. This explanation was readily understood by Melanie, who was hypersensitive about all matters relating to childbirth. Melanie wanted another baby badly, but both Dr. Meade and Dr. Fontaine had said another child would cost her life. So, only half resigned to her fate, She spent most of her time with Scarlett, vicariously enjoying a pregnancy not her own. To Scarlett, scarcely wanting her coming child, and irritated at its untimeliness, this attitude seemed the height of sentimental stupidity. But she had a guilty sense of pleasure that the doctor's edict had made impossible any real intimacy between Ashley and his wife. Scarlett saw Ashley frequently now, but she never saw him alone. He came by the house every night on his way home from the mill to report on the day's work. But Frank and Pitty were usually present, or worse still, Melanie and India. She could only ask business-like questions and make suggestions, and then say, "It was nice of you to come by. Good night." If only she wasn't having a baby! Here was a God-given opportunity to ride out to the mill with him every morning, through the lonely woods, far from prying eyes, where they could imagine themselves back in the county again, in the unhurried days before the war. No, she wouldn't try to make him say one word of love. She wouldn't refer to love in any way. She'd sworn an oath to herself that she would never do that again. But perhaps, if she were alone with him once more, he might drop that mask of impersonal courtesy he had worn since coming to Atlanta. Perhaps he might be his old self again, be the Ashley she had known before the barbecue, before any word of love had been spoken between them. If they couldn't be lovers, they could be friends again, and she could warm her cold and lonely heart in the glow of his friendship. "If only I could get this baby over and done with," she thought impatiently. "Then I could ride with him every day, and we could talk." It was not only the desire to be with him that made her writhe with helpless impatience at her confinement. The Mills needed her. The Mills had been losing money ever since she retired from active supervision, leaving Hugh and Ashley in charge. Hugh was so incompetent for all that he tried so hard. He was a poor trader and a poorer boss of labor. Anyone could jew him down on prices. If any slick contractor chose to say that the lumber was of an inferior grade and not worth the price asked, Hugh felt that all a gentleman could do was to apologize and take a lower price. When she heard of the price he received for 1,000 feet of flooring, she burst into angry tears. The best grade of flooring the mill had ever turned out, and he'd practically given it away. And he couldn't manage his labor crews. The Negroes insisted on being paid every day, and they frequently got drunk on their wages and didn't turn up for work the next morning. On these occasions, Hugh was forced to hunt up new workmen, and the mill was late in starting. With these difficulties, Hugh didn't get into town to sell the lumber for days on end. Seeing the profit slip from Hugh's fingers, Scarlett became frenzied at her impotence and his stupidity. Just as soon as the baby was born and she could go back to work, she would get rid of Hugh and hire someone else. Anyone would do better. And she would never fool with free niggers again. How could anyone get any work done with free niggers quitting all the time? "Frank," she said after a stormy interview with Hugh over his missing workman, "I've about made up my mind that I'll lease convicts to work the mills. A while back I was talking to Johnny Gallagher, Tommy Welburn's foreman, about the trouble we were having getting any work out of the darkies, and he asked me why I didn't get convicts. It sounds like a good idea to me. He said I could sublease them for next to nothing and feed them dirt cheap. And he said I could get work out of them in any way I liked, without having the Freedmen's Bureau swarming down on me like hornets, sticking their bills into things that aren't any of their business. And just as soon as Johnny Gallagher's contract with Tommy is up, I'm going to hire him to run Hugh's mill. Any man who can get work out of that bunch of wild Irish he bosses can certainly get plenty of work out of convicts." Convicts? Frank was speechless. Leasing convicts was the very worst of all the wild schemes Scarlett had ever suggested. Worse even than her notion of building a saloon. At least, it seemed worse to Frank and the conservative circles in which he moved. This new system of leasing convicts had come into being because of the poverty of the state after the war. Unable to support the convicts, the state was hiring them out to those needing large labor crews in the building of railroads, in turpentine forests and lumber camps. While Frank and his quiet church-going friends realized the necessity of the system, they deplored it just the same. Many of them had not even believed in slavery, and they thought this was far worse than slavery had ever been. And Scarlett wanted to lease convicts. Frank knew that if she did, he could never hold up his head again. This was far worse than owning and operating the mills herself, or anything else she had done. His past objections had always been coupled with the question, "What will people say?" But this went deeper than fear of public opinion. He felt it was a traffic in human bodies on a par with prostitution, a sin that would be on his soul if he permitted her to do it. From this conviction of wrongness, Frank gathered courage to forbid Scarlett to do such a thing, and so strong were his remarks that she, startled, relapsed into silence. Finally, to quiet him, she said meekly she hadn't really meant it. She was just so outdone with Hugh and the free niggers she had lost her temper. Secretly, she still thought about it, and with some longing. Convict labor would settle one of her hardest problems, but if Frank was going to take on so about it, she sighed. If even one of the mills were making money, she could stand it. But Ashley was faring little better with his mill than Hugh. At first Scarlett was shocked and disappointed that Ashley didn't immediately take hold and make the mill pay double what it had paid under her management. He was so smart, and he had read so many books, and there was no reason at all why he should not make a brilliant success and lots of money. But he was no more successful than Hugh. His inexperience, his errors, his utter lack of business judgment, and his scruples about close dealing were the same as Hugh's. Scarlett's love hastily found excuses for him, and she didn't consider the two men in the same light. Hugh was just hopelessly stupid, while Ashley was merely new at the business. Still, unbidden, came the thought that Ashley could never make a quick estimate in his head and give a price that was correct, as she could. And she sometimes wondered if he'd ever learn to distinguish between planking and sills. And because he was a gentleman and himself trustworthy, he trusted every scoundrel who came along, and several times would have lost money for her if she had not tactfully intervened. And if he liked a person, and he seemed to like so many people, he sold them lumber on credit without ever thinking to find out if they had money in the bank or property. He was as bad as Frank in that respect. But surely he would learn. And while he was learning, she had a fond and maternal indulgence and patience for his errors. Every evening when he called at her house, weary and discouraged, she was tireless in her tactful, helpful suggestions. But for all her encouragement and cheer, there was a queer, dead look in his eyes. She couldn't understand it, and it frightened her. He was different, so different from the man he used to be. If only she could see him alone, perhaps she could discover the reason. The situation gave her many sleepless nights. She worried about Ashley, both because she knew he was unhappy and because she knew his unhappiness wasn't helping him to become a good lumber dealer. It was a torture to have her mills in the hands of two men with no more business sense than Hugh and Ashley. Heartbreaking to see her competitors taking her best customers away when she had worked so hard and planned so carefully for these helpless months. Oh, if she could only get back to work again! She would take Ashley in hand, and then he would certainly learn. And Johnny Gallagher could run the other mill, and she could handle the selling, and then everything would be fine. And as for Hugh, he could drive a delivery wagon if he still wanted to work for her. That was all he was good for. Of course, Gallagher looked like an unscrupulous man, for all of his smartness, but who else could she get? Why had the other men, who were both smart and honest, been so perverse about working for her? If she only had one of them working for her now in place of Hugh, she wouldn't have to worry so much, but... Tommy Welburn, in spite of his crippled back, was the busiest contractor in town and coining money, so people said. Mrs. Merriweather and Renee were prospering, and now had opened a bakery downtown. Renee was managing it with true French thrift, and Grandpa Merriweather, glad to escape from his chimney corner, was driving Renee's pie wagon. The Simmons boys were so busy they were operating their brick kiln with three shifts of labor a day. And Kells Whiting was cleaning up money with his hair straightener, because he told the Negroes they wouldn't ever be permitted to vote the Republican ticket if they had kinky hair. It was the same with all the smart young men she knew, the doctors, the lawyers, the storekeepers. The apathy which had clutched them immediately after the war had completely disappeared, and they were too busy building their own fortunes to help her build hers. The ones who weren't busy were the men of Hugh's type, or Ashley's. What a mess it was to try to run a business and have a baby, too! I'll never have another one, she decided firmly. I'm not going to be like other women and have a baby every year. Good Lord! That would mean 6 months out of the year when I'd have to be away from the mills. And I see now I can't afford to be away from them even one day. I shall simply tell Frank that I won't have any more children. Frank wanted a big family. But she could manage Frank somehow. Her mind was made up. This was her last child. The mills were far more important. Chapter 42. Scarlett's child was a girl, a small, bald-headed mite, ugly as a hairless monkey, and absurdly like Frank. No one except the doting father could see anything beautiful about her, but the neighbors were charitable enough to say that all ugly babies turned out pretty, eventually. She was named Ella Lorena. Ella for her grandmother Ellen, and Lorena because it was the most fashionable name of the day for girls, even as Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson were popular for boys, and Abraham Lincoln and emancipation for Negro children. She was born in the middle of a week when frenzied excitement gripped Atlanta, and the air was tense with expectation of disaster. A Negro who had boasted of rape had actually been arrested. But before he could be brought to trial, the jail had been raided by the Ku Klux Klan, and he had been quietly hanged. The Klan had acted to save the as-yet-unnamed victim from having to testify in open court. Rather than have her appear and advertise her shame, her father and brother would have shot her. So lynching the Negro seemed a sensible solution to the townspeople, in fact, the only decent solution possible. But the military authorities were in a fury. They saw no reason why the girl should mind testifying publicly. The soldiers made arrests right and left, swearing to wipe out the Klan if they had to put every white man in Atlanta in jail. The Negroes, frightened and sullen, muttered of retaliatory house burnings. The air was thick with rumors of wholesale hangings by the Yankees should the guilty parties be found, and of a concerted uprising against the whites by the Negroes. The people of the town stayed at home behind locked doors and shuttered windows, the men fearing to go to their businesses and leave their women and children unprotected. Scarlett, lying exhausted in bed, feebly and silently thanked God that Ashley had too much sense to belong to the Klan, and Frank was too old and poor-spirited. How dreadful it would be to know that the Yankees might swoop down and arrest them at any minute. Why didn't the crack-brained young fools in the Klan leave bad enough alone and not stir up the Yankees like this? Probably the girl hadn't been raped after all. Probably she'd just been frightened silly, and because of her, a lot of men might lose their lives. In this atmosphere, as nerve-straining as watching a slow fuse burn toward a barrel of gunpowder. Scarlet came rapidly back to strength. The healthy vigor which had carried her through the hard days at Terra stood her in good stead now, and within 2 weeks of Ella Lorena's birth, she was strong enough to sit up and chafe at her inactivity. In 3 weeks, she was up, declaring she had to see to the mills. They were standing idle because both Hugh and Ashley feared to leave their families alone all day. Then, the blow fell. Frank, full of pride of new fatherhood, summoned up courage enough to forbid Scarlet leaving the house while conditions were so dangerous. His commands would not have worried her at all, and she would have gone about her business in spite of them, if he had not put her horse and buggy in the livery stable and ordered that they should not be surrendered to anyone except himself. To make matters worse, he and Mammy had patiently searched the house while she was ill and unearthed her hidden store of money, and Frank had deposited it in the bank in his own name, so now she could not even hire a rig. Scarlet raged at both Frank and Mammy, then was reduced to begging and finally cried all one morning like a furious, thwarted child. But for all her pain, she heard only, "There, sugar, you're just a sick little girl, and, Miss Scarlet, if you don't quit carrying on so, you gwan sour your milk and de baby have colic. Show as guns iron." In a furious temper, Scarlet charged through her backyard to Melanie's house and there unburdened herself at the top of her voice, declaring she would walk to the mills. She would go about Atlanta telling everyone what a varmint she had married. She would not be treated like a naughty, simple-minded child. She would carry a pistol and shoot anyone who threatened her. She had shot one man, and she would love, yes, love, to shoot another. She would... Melanie, who feared to venture onto her own front porch, was appalled by such threats. "Oh, you must not risk yourself. I should die if anything happened to you. Oh, please, I will... I will. I will walk. Melanie looked at her and saw that this was not the hysteria of a woman still weak from childbirth. There was the same breakneck, headlong determination in Scarlet's face that Melanie had often seen in Gerald O'Hara's face when his mind was made up. She put her arms around Scarlet's waist and held her tightly. "It's all my fault for not being brave like you and for keeping Ashley at home with me all this time, when he should have been at the mill. Oh, dear, I'm such a ninny. Darling, I'll tell Ashley I'm not a bit frightened, and I'll come over and stay with you and Aunt Pity, and he can go back to work, and..." Not even to herself would Scarlet admit that she didn't think Ashley could cope with the situation alone, and she shouted, "You'll do nothing of the kind! What earthly good would Ashley do at work if he was worried about you every minute? Everybody is just so hateful. Even Uncle Peter refuses to go out with me. But I don't care. I'll go alone. I'll walk every step of the way and pick up a crew of darkies somewhere." "Oh, no. You mustn't do that. Something dreadful might happen to you. They say that shanty town settlement on the Decatur Road is just full of mean darkies, and you'll have to pass right by it. Let me think. Darling, promise me you won't do anything today, and I'll think of something. Promise me you'll go home and lie down. You look right peaked. Promise me." Because she was too exhausted by her anger to do otherwise, Scarlet sulkily promised and went home, haughtily refusing any overtures of peace from her household. That afternoon, a strange figure stumped through Melanie's hedge and across Pity's backyard. Obviously, he was one of those men whom Mammy and Dilsey referred to as "de riff-raff what Miss Melly pick up off de streets and let sleep in her cellar." There were three rooms in the basement of Melanie's house, which formerly had been servants' quarters and a wine room. Now Dilsey occupied one, and the other two were in constant use by a stream of miserable and ragged transients. No one but Melanie knew whence they came or where they were going, and no one but she knew where she collected them. Perhaps the Negroes were right, and she did pick them up from the streets. But even as the great and the near-great gravitated to her small parlor, so unfortunates found their way to her cellar where they were fed, bedded, and sent on their way with packages of food. Usually the occupants of the rooms were former Confederate soldiers of the rougher, illiterate type, homeless men, men without families, beating their way about the country in hope of finding work. Frequently, brown and withered country women with broods of tow-haired silent children spent the night there, women widowed by the war, dispossessed of their farms, seeking relatives who were scattered and lost. Sometimes the neighborhood was scandalized by the presence of foreigners, speaking little or no English, who had been drawn south by glowing tales of fortunes easily made. Once a Republican had slept there. At least, Mammy insisted he was Republican, saying she could smell a Republican, same as a horse could smell a rattlesnake. But no one believed Mammy's story, for there must be some limit even to Melanie's charity. At least everyone hoped so. Yes, thought Scarlett, sitting on the side porch in the pale November sunshine with a baby on her lap. He's one of Melanie's lame dogs. And he's really lame, at that. The man who was making his way across the backyard stumped like Will Benteen on a wooden leg. He was a tall, thin old man with a bald head, which shone pinkishly dirty, and a grizzled beard so long he could tuck it in his belt. He was over 60, to judge by his hard-seamed face. But there was no sag of age to his body. He was lank and ungainly, but even with his wooden peg he moved as swiftly as a snake. He mounted the steps and came toward her, and even before he spoke, revealing in his tones a twang and burring of R's unusual in the lowlands, Scarlet knew that he was mountain-born. For all his dirty, ragged clothes, there was about him, as about most mountaineers, an air of fierce, silent pride that permitted no liberties and tolerated no foolishness. His beard was stained with tobacco juice, and a large wad in his jaw made his face look deformed. His nose was thin and craggy, his eyebrows bushy and twisted into witches' locks, and a lush growth of hair sprang from his ears, giving them the tufted look of a lynx's ears. Beneath his brow was one hollow socket, from which a scar ran down his cheek, carving a diagonal line through his beard. The other eye was small, pale and cold, an unwinking and remorseless eye. There was a heavy pistol openly in his trouser band, and from the top of his tattered boot protruded the hilt of a bowie knife. He returned Scarlet's stare coldly and spat across the rail of the banister before he spoke. There was contempt in his one eye, not a personal contempt for her, but for her whole sex. "Miss Wilkes sent me to work for you," he said shortly. He spoke rustily, as one unaccustomed to speaking, the words coming slowly and almost with difficulty. "My name's Archie." "I'm sorry, but I have no work for you, Mr. Archie."
"Archie's my first name."
"I beg your pardon. What's your last name?" He spat again.
"I reckon that's my business," he said. "Archie'll do."
"I don't care what your last name is. I have nothing for you to do."
"I reckon you have. Miss Wilkes was upset about your wanting to run around like a fool by yourself, and she sent me over here to drive around with you."
"Indeed," cried Scarlet, indignant both at the man's rudeness and Melly's meddling. His one eye met hers with an impersonal animosity.
"Yes, a woman's got no business bothering her men folks when they're trying to take care of her. If you're bound to gad about, I'll drive you. I hate niggers. Yankees, too."
He shifted his wad of tobacco to the other cheek and, without waiting for an invitation, sat down on the top step.
I ain't saying I like driving women around, but Miss Wilkes been good to me, letting me sleep in her cellar. And she sent me to drive you.
But, began Scarlet helplessly. And then she stopped and looked at him. After a moment, she began to smile. She didn't like the looks of this elderly desperado, but his presence would simplify matters. With him beside her, she could go to town, drive to the mills, call on customers. No one could doubt her safety with him, and his very appearance was enough to keep from giving rise to scandal.
"It's a bargain," she said. "That is, if my husband agrees." After a private conversation with Archie, Frank gave his reluctant approval and sent word to the livery stable to release the horse and buggy. He was hurt and disappointed that motherhood had not changed Scarlet, as he had hoped it would, but if she was determined to go back to her damnable mills, then Archie was a godsend. So began the relationship that at first startled Atlanta. Archie and Scarlet were a queerly assorted pair, the truculent, dirty old man with his wooden peg sticking stiffly out over the dashboard, and the pretty, neatly dressed young woman with forehead puckered in an abstracted frown. They could be seen at all hours and at all places in and near Atlanta, seldom speaking to each other, obviously disliking each other, but bound together by mutual need, he of money, she of protection. At least, said the ladies of the town, it's better than riding around so brazenly with that butler man. They wondered curiously where Rhett was these days, for he had abruptly left town 3 months before, and no one, not even Scarlet, knew where he was. Archie was a silent man, never speaking unless spoken to, and usually answering with grunts. Every morning he came from Melanie's cellar and sat on the front steps of Pity's house, chewing and spitting until Scarlet came out, and Peter brought the buggy from the stable. Uncle Peter feared him only a little less than the devil or the Ku Klux, and even Mammy walked silently and timorously around him. He hated Negroes, and they knew it, and feared him. He reinforced his pistol and knife with another pistol, and his fame spread far among the black population. He never once had to draw a pistol or even lay his hand on his belt. The moral effect was sufficient. No Negro dared even laugh while Archie was in hearing. Once Scarlet asked him curiously why he hated Negroes and was surprised when he answered, for generally all questions were answered by, "I reckon that's my business." "I hates them, like all mountain folks hates them. We never liked them, and we never owned none. It was them niggers that started the war. I hates them for that, too." "But you fought in the war."
"I reckon that's a man's privilege. I hates Yankees, too, more'n I hates niggers. Most as much as I hates talkative women."
It was such outspoken rudeness as this that threw Scarlet into silent furies and made her long to be rid of him. But how could she do without him? In what other way could she obtain such freedom? He was rude and dirty, and occasionally very odorous, but he served his purpose. He drove her to and from the mills, and on her round of customers, spitting and staring off into space while she talked and gave orders. If she climbed down from the buggy, he climbed after her and dogged her footsteps. When she was among rough laborers, Negroes or Yankee soldiers, he was seldom more than a pace from her elbow. Soon Atlanta became accustomed to seeing Scarlet and her bodyguard, and from being accustomed, the ladies grew to envy her freedom of movement. Since the Ku Klux lynching, the ladies had been practically immured, not even going to town to shop unless they were half a dozen in their group. Naturally social-minded, they became restless, and, putting their pride in their pockets, they began to beg the loan of Archie from Scarlet. And whenever she didn't need him, she was gracious enough to spare him for the use of other ladies. Soon Archie became an Atlanta institution, and the ladies competed for his free time. There was seldom a morning when a child or a Negro servant didn't arrive at breakfast time with a note saying, "If you aren't using Archie this afternoon, do let me have him. I want to drive to the cemetery with flowers."
"I must go to the milliner's."
"I should like Archie to drive Aunt Nellie for an airing." "I must go calling on Peter Street, and Grandpa is not feeling well enough to take me. Could Archie?" He drove them all, maids, matrons, and widows, and toward all he evidenced the same uncompromising contempt. It was obvious that he didn't like women, Melanie accepted, any better than he liked Negroes and Yankees. Shocked at first by his rudeness, the ladies finally became accustomed to him, and as he was so silent, except for intermittent explosions of tobacco juice, they took him as much for granted as the horses he drove, and forgot his very existence. In fact, Mrs. Merriweather related to Mrs. Meade the complete details of her niece's confinement before she even remembered Archie's presence on the front seat of the carriage. And no other time than this could such a situation have been possible. Before the war, he would not have been permitted even in the ladies' kitchens. They would have handed him food through the back door and sent him about his business. But now they welcomed his reassuring presence. Rude, illiterate, dirty, he was a bulwark between the ladies and the terrors of Reconstruction. He was neither friend nor servant. He was a hired bodyguard, protecting the women while their men worked by day or were absent from home at night. It seemed to Scarlett that after Archie came to work for her, Frank was away at night very frequently. He said the books at the store had to be balanced, and business was brisk enough now to give him little time to attend to this in working hours, and there were sick friends with whom he had to sit. Then there was the organization of Democrats, who foregathered every Wednesday night to devise ways of regaining the ballot, and Frank never missed a meeting. Scarlett thought this organization did little else except argue the merits of General John B. Gordon over every other general, except General Lee, and refight the war. Certainly she could observe no progress in the direction of the recovery of the ballot. But Frank evidently enjoyed the meetings, for he stayed out until all hours on those nights. Ashley also sat up with the sick, and he, too, attended the Democratic meetings, and he was usually away on the same nights as Frank. On these nights, Archie escorted Pitty, Scarlett, Wade, and little Ella through the backyard to Melanie's house, and the two families spent the evenings together. The ladies sewed while Archie lay full length on the parlor sofa snoring, his gray whiskers fluttering at each rumble. No one had invited him to dispose himself on the sofa, and as it was the finest piece of furniture in the house, the ladies secretly moaned every time he lay down on it, planting his boot on the pretty upholstery. But none of them had the courage to remonstrate with him, especially after he remarked that it was lucky he went to sleep easy, for otherwise the sound of women clattering like a flock of guinea hens would certainly drive him crazy. Scarlett sometimes wondered where Archie had come from, and what his life had been before he came to live in Melly's cellar, but she asked no questions. There was that about his grim, one-eyed face which discouraged curiosity. All she knew was that his voice bespoke the mountains to the north, and that he had been in the army and had lost both leg and eye shortly before the surrender. It was words spoken in a fit of anger against Hugh Elsing, which brought out the truth of Archie's past. One morning, the old man had driven her to Hugh's mill, and she had found it idle. The Negroes gone and Hugh sitting despondently under a tree. His crew hadn't made their appearance that morning, and he was at a loss as to what to do. Scarlett was in a furious temper and didn't scruple to extend it on Hugh, for she had just received an order for a large amount of lumber, a rush order at that. She had used energy and charm and bargaining to get that order, and now the mill was quiet. "Drive me out to the other mill," she directed Archie. "Yes, I know it'll take a long time, and we won't get any dinner, but what am I paying you for? I'll have to make Mr. Wilkes stop what he's doing and run me off this lumber. Like as not, his crew won't be working either. Great balls of fire!"
I never saw such a nincompoop as Hugh Elsing. I'm going to get rid of him just as soon as that Johnny Gallagher finishes the stores he's building.
What do I care if Gallagher was in the Yankee army? He'll work. I never saw a lazy Irishman yet. And I'm through with free-issue darkies. You just can't depend on them. I'm going to get Johnny Gallagher and lease me some convicts. He'll get work out of them. He'll...
Archie turned to her, his eye malevolent, and when he spoke, there was cold anger in his rusty voice.
The day you gets convicts is the day I quits you, he said.
Scarlet was startled.
Good heavens! Why?
I knows about convict leasing. I calls it convict murdering. Buying men like they was mules. Treating them worse than mules was ever treated. Beating them, starving them, killing them, and who cares? The state don't care. It's got the lease money. The folks that gets the convicts, they don't care. All they want is to feed them cheap and get all the work they can out of them. Hell, ma'am. I never thought much of women, and I think less of them now.
Is it any of your business?
I reckon,
said Archie laconically. And after a pause,
I was a convict for nigh on to 40 years.
Scarlet gasped, and for a moment shrank back against the cushions. This, then, was the answer to the riddle of Archie. His unwillingness to tell his last name or the place of his birth or any scrap of his past life. The answer to the difficulty with which he spoke and his cold hatred of the world. 40 years. He must have gone into prison a young man. 40 years. Why, he must have been a life prisoner, and lifers were... Was it murder?
Yes,
answered Archie briefly as he flapped the reins.
My wife.
Scarlet's eyelids batted rapidly with fright. The mouth beneath the beard seemed to move, as if he was smiling grimly at her fear.
I ain't gonna kill you, ma'am, if that's what's fretting you. There ain't but one reason for killing a woman.
You killed your wife?
She was laying with my brother. He got away. I ain't sorry none that I killed her. Loose women ought to be killed. The law ain't got no right to put a man in jail for that, but I was sent.
But how did you get out? Did you escape? Were you pardoned?
You might call it a pardon.
His thick gray brows writhed together as though the effort of stringing words together was difficult.
Long in 64, when Sherman came through, I was at Milledgeville Jail, like I'd been for 40 years. And the warden, he called all us prisoners together, and he says, the Yankees are a-comin', a-burnin' and a-killin'. Now, if there's one thing I hates worse than a nigger or a woman, it's a Yankee.
Why? Did you ever know any Yankees?
No'm, but I heard tell 'em. I heard tell they couldn't never mind their own business. I hates folks who can't mind their own business. What was they doing in Georgia freeing our niggers and burning our houses and killing our stock? Well, the warden, he said the army needed more soldiers bad, and any of us who'd join up would be free at the end of the war, if we come out alive. But us lifers, us murderers, the warden, he said, the army didn't want us. We was to be sent somewheres else to another jail. But I said to the warden, I ain't like most lifers. I'm just in for killing my wife, and she needed killing. And I wants to fight the Yankees. And the warden, he saw my side of it, and he slipped me out with the other prisoners.
He paused and grunted.
Huh. That was right funny. They put me in jail for killing, and they let me out with a gun in my hand and a free pardon to do more killing. It sure was good to be a free man with a rifle in my hand again. Us men from Milledgeville did good fighting and killing, and a lot of us was killed. I never knowed one who deserted, and when the surrender came, we was free. I lost this year leg and this year eye, but I ain't sorry.
Oh, said Scarlet, weakly.
She tried to remember what she had heard about the releasing of the Milledgeville convicts in that last desperate effort to stem the tide of Sherman's army. Frank had mentioned it that Christmas of 1864. What had he said? But her memories of that time were too chaotic. Again she felt the wild terror of those days, heard the siege guns, saw the line of wagons dripping blood into the red roads, saw the home guard marching off, the little cadets and the children like Phil Meade, and the old men like Uncle Henry and Grandpa Merriweather. And the convicts had marched out, too, to die in the twilight of the Confederacy, to freeze in the snow and sleet of that last campaign in Tennessee. For a brief moment she thought what a fool this old man was, to fight for a state which had taken 40 years from his life. Georgia had taken his youth and his middle years for a crime that was no crime to him, yet he had freely given a leg and an eye to Georgia. The bitter words Rhett had spoken in the early days of the war came back to her, and she remembered him saying he would never fight for a society that had made him an outcast. But when the emergency had arisen, he had gone off to fight for that same society, even as Archie had done. It seemed to her that all Southern men, high or low, were sentimental fools, and cared less for their hides than for words which had no meaning. She looked at Archie's gnarled old hands, his two pistols and his knife, and fear pricked her again. Were there other ex-convicts at large, like Archie, murderers, desperados, thieves, pardoned for their crimes in the name of the Confederacy? Why, any stranger on the street might be a murderer. If Frank ever learned the truth about Archie, there would be the devil to pay. Or if Aunt Pity... But the shock would kill Pity. And as for Melanie... Scarlett almost wished she could tell Melanie the truth about Archie. It would serve her right for picking up trash and foisting it off on her friends and relatives. I'm glad you told me, Archie. I won't tell anyone. It would be a great shock to Mrs. Wilkes and the other ladies if they knew.
Huh? Miss Wilkes knows. I told her the night she first let me sleep in her cellar. You don't think I'd let a nice lady like her take me into her house not knowing?
Saints preserve us! Cried Scarlett, aghast. Melanie knew this man was a murderer and a woman murderer at that, and she hadn't ejected him from her house. She had trusted her son with him, and her aunt and sister-in-law and all her friends. And she, the most timid of females, had not been frightened to be alone with him in her house.
Miss Wilkes is right sensible, for a woman. She allowed that I was all right. She allowed that a liar always kept on lying and that a thief kept on stealing, but folks don't do more'n one murder in a lifetime. And she reckoned as how anybody who fought for the Confederacy had wiped out anything bad they'd done. Though I don't hold that I'd done nothing bad, killing my wife. Yes, Miss Wilkes is right sensible for a woman. And I'm telling you, the day you leases convicts is the day I quits you.
Scarlett made no reply, but she thought, "The sooner you quit me, the better it will suit me. A murderer." How could Melly have been so... Well, there was no word for Melanie's action in taking in this old ruffian and not telling her friends he was a jailbird. So service in the army wiped out past sins. Melanie had that mixed up with baptism. But then Melanie was utterly silly about the Confederacy, its veterans, and anything pertaining to them. Scarlett silently damned the Yankees and added another mark on her score against them. They were responsible for a situation that forced a woman to keep a murderer at her side to protect her. Driving home with Archie in the chill twilight, Scarlett saw a clutter of saddle horses, buggies, and wagons outside the Girl of the Period saloon. Ashley was sitting on his horse, a strained, alert look on his face. The Simmons boys were leaning from their buggy, making emphatic gestures. Hugh Elsing, his lock of brown hair falling in his eyes, was waving his hands. Grandpa Merriweather's pie wagon was in the center of the tangle, and as she came closer, Scarlett saw that Tommy Wilburn and Uncle Henry Hamilton were crowded on the seat with him. "I wish," thought Scarlett irritably, "that Uncle Henry wouldn't ride home in that contraption. He ought to be ashamed to be seen in it. It isn't as though he didn't have a horse of his own. He just does it so he and Grandpa can go to the saloon together every night." As she came abreast the crowd, something of their tenseness reached her, insensitive though she was, and made a fear clutch at her heart. "Oh," she thought, "I hope no one else has been raped. If the Ku Klux lynch just one more darkie, the Yankees will wipe us out." And she spoke to Archie. "Pull up. Something's wrong."
"You ain't going to stop outside a saloon," said Archie.
"You heard me. Pull up." "Good evening, everybody. Ashley, Uncle Henry, is something wrong? You all look so..." The crowd turned to her, tipping their hats and smiling, but there was a driving excitement in their eyes.
"Something's right and something's wrong," barked Uncle Henry. "Depends on how you look at it. The way I figure is the legislature couldn't have done different."
The legislature, thought Scarlett in relief. She had little interest in the legislature, feeling that its doings could hardly affect her. It was the prospect of the Yankee soldiers on a rampage again that frightened her. "What's the legislature been up to now?"
"They've flatly refused to ratify the amendment," said Grandpa Merriweather, and there was pride in his voice. "That'll show the Yankees."
"And they'll be held to pay for it." "I beg your pardon, Scarlett," said Ashley. "Oh, the amendment?" questioned Scarlett, trying to look intelligent. Politics were beyond her, and she seldom wasted time thinking about them. There had been a 13th Amendment ratified some time before, or maybe it had been the 16th Amendment, but what ratification meant she had no idea. Men were always getting excited about such things. Something of her lack of comprehension showed in her face, and Ashley smiled.
"It's the amendment letting the darkies vote, you know," he explained. "It was submitted to the legislature, and they refused to ratify it."
"How silly of them! You know the Yankees are going to force it down our throats."
"That's what I meant by saying they'll be held to pay," said Ashley. "I'm proud of the legislature and proud of their gumption," shouted Uncle Henry. "The Yankees can't force it down our throats if we won't have it."
"They can, and they will."
Ashley's voice was calm, but there was worry in his eyes.
"And it'll make things just that much harder for us."
"Oh, Ashley, surely not. Things couldn't be any harder than they are now."
"Yes, things can get worse, even worse than they are now. Suppose we have a darky legislature, a darky governor. Suppose we have a worse military rule than we now have."
Scarlett's eyes grew large with fear as some understanding entered her mind.
"I've been trying to think what would be best for Georgia, best for all of us." Ashley's face was drawn. "Whether it's wisest to fight this thing like the legislature has done, rouse the North against us and bring the whole Yankee army on us to cram the darky vote down us, whether we want it or not. Or swallow our pride as best we can, submit gracefully and get the whole matter over with as easily as possible. It will amount to the same thing in the end. We are helpless. We've got to take the dose they're determined to give us. Maybe it would be better for us to take it without kicking."
Scarlett hardly heard his words. Certainly their full import went over her head. She knew that Ashley, as usual, was seeing both sides of a question. She was only seeing one side, how this slap in the Yankees' faces might affect her.
"Going to turn radical and vote the Republican ticket, Ashley?" jeered Grandpa Merriweather harshly.
There was a tense silence. Scarlett saw Archie's hand make a swift move toward his pistol and then stop. Archie thought, and frequently said,
that Grandpa was an old bag of wind, and Archie had no intention of letting him insult Miss Melanie's husband, even if Miss Melanie's husband was talking like a fool. The perplexity vanished suddenly from Ashley's eyes, and hot anger flared, but before he could speak, Uncle Henry charged Grandpa.
You blessed. I beg your pardon, Scarlet. Grandpa, you jackass. Don't you say that to Ashley. Ashley can take care of himself without you defending him, said Grandpa coldly. And he's talking like a scallywag. Submit. Hell! I beg your pardon, Scarlet.
I didn't believe in secession, said Ashley, and his voice shook with anger.
But when Georgia seceded, I went with her. And I didn't believe in war, but I fought in the war. And I don't believe in making the Yankees madder than they already are. But if the legislature has decided to do it, I'll stand by the legislature. Archie, said Uncle Henry abruptly, drive Miss Scarlet on home. This isn't any place for her. Politics aren't for women folks anyway, and they're going to be cussing in a minute. Go on, Archie. Good night, Scarlet.
As they drove off down Peachtree Street, Scarlet's heart was beating fast with fear. Would this foolish action of the legislature have any effect on her safety? Would it so enrage the Yankees that she might lose her mills?
Well, sir, rumbled Archie, I've heard tell of rabbits spitting in bulldogs' faces, but I ain't never seen it till now. Them legislatures might just as well have hollered, hooray for Jeff Davis and the Southern Confederacy, for all the good it'll do 'em. And us. Them nigger-loving Yankees have made up their mind to make the niggers our bosses. But you got to admire them legislature spirit.
Admire them? Great balls of fire! Admire them? They ought to be shot. It'll bring the Yankees down on us like a duck on a June bug. Why couldn't they have ratted whatever they were supposed to do to it and smooth the Yankees down instead of stirring them up again? They're going to make us knuckle under, and we may as well knuckle under now as later.
Archie fixed her with a cold eye.
Knuckle under without a fight? Women ain't got no more pride than goats.
When Scarlet leased 10 convicts, 5 for each of her mills, Archie made good his threat and refused to have anything further to do with her. Not all Melanie's pleading or Frank's promises of higher pay would induce him to take up the reins again. He willingly escorted Melanie and Pity and India and their friends about the town, but not Scarlet. He would not even drive for the other ladies if Scarlet was in the carriage. It was an embarrassing situation, having the old desperado sitting in judgment upon her, and it was still more embarrassing to know that her family and friends agreed with the old man. Frank pleaded with her against taking the step. Ashley at first refused to work convicts and was persuaded against his will, only after tears and supplications and promises that when times were better she would hire free darkies. Neighbors were so outspoken in their disapproval that Frank, Pity, and Melanie found it hard to hold up their heads. Even Peter and Mammy declared that it was bad luck to work convicts and no good would come of it. Everyone said it was wrong to take advantage of the miseries and misfortunes of others. "You didn't have any objections to working slaves," Scarlet cried indignantly.
"Ah, but that was different. Slaves were neither miserable nor unfortunate. The Negroes were far better off under slavery than they were now under freedom. And if she didn't believe it, just look about her. But as usual, opposition had the effect of making Scarlet more determined on her course. She removed Hugh from the management of the mill, put him to driving a lumber wagon, and closed the final details of hiring Johnny Gallagher. He seemed to be the only person she knew who approved of the convicts. He nodded his bullet head briefly and said it was a smart move. Scarlet, looking at the little ex-jockey planted firmly on his short, bowed legs, his gnomish face hard and businesslike, thought, "Whoever let him ride their horses didn't care much for horse flesh.
I wouldn't let him get within 10 feet of any horse of mine.
But she had no qualms in trusting him with a convict gang.
"And I'm to have a free hand with the gang?" he questioned, his eyes as cold as gray agates.
"A free hand? All I ask is that you keep my mill running and deliver my lumber when I want it and as much as I want."
"I'm your man," said Johnny shortly. "I'll tell Mr. Welburn I'm leaving him."
As he rolled off through the crowd of masons and carpenters and hod carriers, Scarlet felt relieved and her spirits rose. Johnny was indeed her man. He was tough and hard, and there was no nonsense about him.
"Shanty Irish on the make," Frank had contemptuously called him.
But for that very reason Scarlet valued him. She knew that an Irishman with a determination to get somewhere was a valuable man to have, regardless of what his personal characteristics might be. And she felt a closer kinship with him than with many men of her own class, for Johnny knew the value of money. The first week he took over the mill, he justified all her hopes, for he accomplished more with 5 convicts than Hugh had ever done with his crew of 10 free Negroes. More than that, he gave Scarlet greater leisure than she had had since she came to Atlanta the year before, because he had no liking for her presence at the mill and said so frankly.
"You tend to your end of selling and let me tend to my end of lumbering," he said shortly. "A convict camp ain't any place for a lady, and if nobody else'll tell you so, Johnny Gallagher's telling you now. I'm delivering your lumber, ain't I? Well, I've no notion to be pestered every day like Mr. Wilkes. He needs pestering. I don't."
So Scarlet reluctantly stayed away from Johnny's mill, fearing that if she came too often he might quit, and that would be ruinous. His remark that Ashley needed pestering stung her, for there was more truth in it than she liked to admit. Ashley was doing little better with convicts than he had done with free labor, although why, he was unable to tell. Moreover, he looked as if he were ashamed to be working convicts, and he had little to say to her these days. Scarlet was worried by the change that was coming over him. There were gray hairs in his bright head now, and a tired slump in his shoulders, and he seldom smiled. He no longer looked the debonair Ashley who had caught her fancy so many years before. He looked like a man secretly gnawed by a scarcely endurable pain, and there was a grim, tight look about his mouth that baffled and hurt her. She wanted to drag his head fiercely down on her shoulder, stroke the graying hair, and cry, "Tell me what's worrying you. I'll fix it. I'll make it right for you." But his formal, remote air kept her at arm's length. Chapter 43. It was one of those rare December days when the sun was almost as warm as Indian summer. Dry red leaves still clung to the oak in Aunt Pitty's yard, and a faint yellow-green still persisted in the dying grass. Scarlet, with the baby in her arms, stepped out onto the side porch and sat down in a rocking chair in a patch of sunshine. She was wearing a new green challis dress trimmed with yards and yards of black rick-rack braid, and a new lace house cap which Aunt Pitty had made for her. Both were very becoming to her, and she knew it, and took great pleasure in them. How good it was to look pretty again after the long months of looking so dreadful! As she sat rocking the baby and humming to herself, she heard the sound of hooves coming up the side street, and peering curiously through the tangle of dead vines on the porch, she saw Rhett Butler riding toward the house. He had been away from Atlanta for months, since just after Gerald died, since long before Ella Lorena was born. She had missed him, but now she wished ardently that there was some way to avoid seeing him. In fact, the sight of his dark face brought a feeling of guilty panic to her breast, a matter in which Ashley was concerned lay on her conscience, and she didn't wish to discuss it with Rhett. But she knew he would force the discussion, no matter how disinclined she might be.
He drew up at the gate and swung lightly to the ground, and she thought, staring nervously at him, that he looked just like an illustration in a book Wade was always pestering her to read aloud. All he needs is earrings and a cutlass between his teeth, she thought. Well, pirate or no, he's not going to cut my throat today if I can help it. As he came up the walk, she called a greeting to him, summoning her sweetest smile. How lucky that she had on her new dress, the becoming cap, and looked so pretty. As his eyes went swiftly over her, she knew he thought her pretty, too.
A new baby! Why, Scarlet, this is a surprise, he laughed, leaning down to push the blanket away from Ella Lorena's small, ugly face.
Don't be silly, she said, blushing. How are you, Rhett? You've been away a long time.
So I have. Let me hold the baby, Scarlet. Oh, I know how to hold babies. I have many strange accomplishments. Well, he certainly looks like Frank, all except the whiskers. But give him time.
I hope not. It's a girl.
A girl? That's better still. Boys are such nuisances. Don't ever have any more boys, Scarlet.
It was on the tip of her tongue to reply tartly that she never intended to have any more babies, boys or girls, but she caught herself in time and smiled, casting about quickly in her mind for some topic of conversation that would put off the bad moment when the subject she feared would come up for discussion. Did you have a nice trip, Rhett? Where did you go this time?
Oh, Cuba, New Orleans, other places. Here, Scarlet, take the baby. She's beginning to slobber, and I can't get to my handkerchief. She's a fine baby, I'm sure, but she's wetting my shirt bosom.
She took the child back into her lap, and Rhett settled himself lazily on the banister and took a cigar from a silver case. You're always going to New Orleans, she said, and pouted a little. And you never will tell me what you do there.
I'm a hard-working man, Scarlet. And perhaps my business takes me there.
Hard-working? You? She laughed impertinently. You never worked a day in your life. You're too lazy. All you ever do is finance carpetbaggers in their thieving and take half the profits and bribe Yankee officials to let you in on schemes to rob us taxpayers. He threw back his head and laughed.
And how you would love to have money enough to bribe officials so you could do likewise.
The very idea, she began to ruffle.
But perhaps you will make enough money to get into bribery on a large scale some day. Maybe you'll get rich off those convicts you leased.
Oh, she said, a little disconcerted. How did you find out about my gang so soon?
I arrived last night and spent the evening in the Girl of the Period saloon, where one hears all the news of the town. It's a clearinghouse for gossip. Better than a lady's sewing circle. Everyone told me that you'd leased a gang and put that little plug-ugly Gallagher in charge to work them to death.
That's a lie, she said angrily. He won't work them to death. I'll see to that.
Will you?
Of course I will. How can you even insinuate such things?
Oh, I do beg your pardon, Mrs. Kennedy.
I know your motives are always above reproach.
However, Johnny Gallagher is a cold little bully, if I ever saw one. Better watch him, or you'll be having trouble when the inspector comes around.
You tend to your business and I'll tend to mine, she said indignantly. And I don't want to talk about convicts anymore. Everybody's been hateful about them. My gang is my own business. And you haven't told me yet what you do in New Orleans. You go there so often that everybody says... She paused. She had not intended to say so much.
What do they say?
Well, that you have a sweetheart there. That you're going to get married. Are you, Rhett? She had been curious about this for so long that she could not refrain from asking the point-blank question. A queer little pang of jealousy jabbed at her at the thought of Rhett getting married, although why that should be she didn't know. His bland eyes grew suddenly alert,
and he caught her gaze and held it until a little blush crept up into her cheeks.
Would it matter much to you?
Well, I should hate to lose your friendship, she said primly, and with an attempt at disinterestedness, bent down to pull the blanket closer about Ella Lorena's head. He laughed suddenly, shortly, and said, "Look at me, Scarlet." She looked up unwillingly, her blush deepening. "You can tell your curious friends that when I marry, it will be because I couldn't get the woman I wanted in any other way. And I've never yet wanted a woman bad enough to marry her." Now she was indeed confused and embarrassed, for she remembered the night on this very porch during the siege when he had said, "I'm not a marrying man," and casually suggested that she become his mistress. Remembered, too, the terrible day when he was in jail and was shamed by the memory. A slow, malicious smile went over his face as he read her eyes. "But I will satisfy your vulgar curiosity, since you ask such pointed questions. It isn't a sweetheart that takes me to New Orleans. It's a child. A little boy."
"A little boy?"
The shock of this unexpected information wiped out her confusion. "Yes. He is my legal ward, and I'm responsible for him. He's in school in New Orleans. I go there frequently to see him."
"And take him presents?"
So she thought. That's how he always knows what kind of presents Wade likes.
"Yes,"
he said shortly, unwillingly.
"Well, I never! Is he handsome?"
"Too handsome for his own good."
"Is he a nice little boy?"
"No, he's a perfect hellion. I wish he'd never been born. Boys are troublesome creatures. Is there anything else you'd like to know?"
He looked suddenly angry, and his brow was dark, as though he already regretted speaking of the matter at all.
"Well, not if you don't want to tell me any more," she said loftily, though she was burning for further information. "But I just can't see you in the role of a guardian." And she laughed, hoping to disconcert him.
"No, I don't suppose you can. Your vision is pretty limited."
He said no more, and smoked his cigar in silence for a while. She cast about for some remark as rude as his, but could think of none.
"I would appreciate it if you'd say nothing of this to anyone," he said finally. "Though I suppose that asking a woman to keep her mouth shut is asking the impossible."
"I can keep a secret," she said with injured dignity.
"Can you? It's nice to learn unsuspected things about friends. Now stop pouting, Scarlet. I'm sorry I was rude, but you deserved it for prying. Give me a smile, and let's be pleasant for a minute or two before I take up an unpleasant subject."
Oh, dear, she thought. Now he's going to talk about Ashley and the mill. And she hastened to smile and show her dimple to divert him.
"Where else did you go, Rhett? You haven't been in New Orleans all this time, have you?"
"No, for the last month I've been in Charleston. My father died."
"Oh, I'm sorry."
"Don't be. I'm sure he wasn't sorry to die, and I'm sure I'm not sorry he's dead."
"Rhett! What a dreadful thing to say!"
"It would be much more dreadful if I pretended to be sorry when I wasn't, wouldn't it? There was never any love lost between us. I cannot remember when the old gentleman did not disapprove of me. I was too much like his own father, and he disapproved hardly of his father. And as I grew older, his disapproval of me became downright dislike, which, I admit, I did little to change. All the things father wanted me to do and be were such boring things. And finally he threw me out into the world without a cent and no training whatsoever to be anything but a Charleston gentleman, a good pistol shot and an excellent poker player. And he seemed to take it as a personal affront that I did not starve, but put my poker playing to excellent advantage and supported myself royally by gambling.
He was so affronted at a butler becoming a gambler that when I came home for the first time, he forbade my mother to see me. All during the war, when I was blockading out of Charleston, mother had to lie and slip off to see me. Naturally, that didn't increase my love for him.
Oh, I didn't know all that.
He was what is pointed out as a fine old gentleman of the old school, which means that he was ignorant, thick-headed, intolerant, and incapable of thinking along any lines except what other gentlemen of the old school thought. Everyone admired him tremendously for having cut me off and counted me as dead. If thy right eye offend thee, pluck it out. I was his right eye, his oldest son, and he plucked me out with a vengeance. He smiled a little, his eyes hard with amused memory. Well, I could forgive all that, but I can't forgive what he's done to Mother and my sister since the war ended. They've been practically destitute. The plantation house was burned and the rice fields have gone back to marshlands. And the townhouse went for taxes, and they've been living in two rooms that aren't fit for darkies. I've sent money to Mother, but Father has sent it back. Tainted money, you see. And several times I've gone to Charleston and given money on the sly to my sister. But Father always found out and raised merry hell with her till life wasn't worth living, poor girl. And back the money came to me. I don't know how they've lived. Yes, I do know. My brother's given what he could, though he hasn't much to give, and he won't take anything from me either. Speculator's money is unlucky money, you see. And the charity of their friends. Your Aunt Eulalie, she's been very kind. She's one of Mother's best friends, you know. She's given them clothes and... Good God! My mother on charity! It was one of the few times she had ever seen him with his mask off. His face hard with honest hatred for his father and distress for his mother.
Aunt Lely, but good heavens, Rhett, she hasn't got anything much above what I send her.
Ah, so that's where it comes from. How ill-bred of you, my dear, to brag of such a thing in the face of my humiliation. You must let me reimburse you.
With pleasure, said Scarlet, her mouth suddenly twisting into a grin.
And he smiled back. Ah, Scarlet, how the thought of a dollar does make your eyes sparkle. Are you sure you haven't some Scotch or perhaps Jewish blood as well as Irish?
Don't be hateful.
I didn't mean to throw it in your face about Aunt Lely. But honestly, she thinks I'm made of money. She's always writing me for more, and God knows I've got enough on my hands without supporting all of Charleston.
What did your father die of?
Genteel starvation, I think. And hope. It served him right. He was willing to let Mother and Rosemary starve with him. Now that he's dead, I can help them. I've bought them a house on the Battery, and they've servants to look after them. But, of course, they couldn't let it be known that the money came from me.
Why not?
My dear, surely you know Charleston. You visited there. My family may be poor, but they have a position to uphold. And they couldn't uphold it if it were known that gambling money and speculators' money and carpetbag money was behind it. No, they gave it out that Father left an enormous life insurance, that he beggared himself and starved himself to death to keep up the payments so that after he died they'd be provided for. So he is looked upon as an even greater gentleman of the old school than before. In fact, a martyr to his family. I hope he's turning in his grave at the knowledge that Mother and Rosemary are comfortable now, in spite of his efforts. In a way, I'm sorry he's dead because he wanted to die. Was so glad to die.
Why?
Oh, he really died when Lee surrendered, you know the type. He never could adjust himself to the new times and spent his time talking about the good old days.
Rhett, are all old folks like that? She was thinking of Gerald and what Will had said about him.
Heavens, no! Just look at your Uncle Henry and that old wildcat, Mr. Merriweather, just to name two. They took a new lease on life when they marched out with the Home Guard, and it seems to me that they've gotten younger and more peppery ever since. I met old man Merriweather this morning driving Renee's pie wagon and cursing the horse like an army mule skinner. He told me he felt 10 years younger since he escaped from the house and his daughter-in-law's coddling and took to driving the wagon. And your Uncle Henry enjoys fighting the Yankees in court and out, and defending the widow and the orphan, free of charge, I fear, against the carpetbaggers. If there hadn't been a war, he'd have retired long ago and nursed his rheumatism. They're young again because they are of use again and feel that they are needed. And they like this new day that gives old men another chance. But there are plenty of people, young people, who feel like my father and your father. They can't and won't adjust, and that brings me to the unpleasant subject I want to discuss with you, Scarlet. His sudden shift so disconcerted her that she stammered. And inwardly groaned. Oh, Lord, now it's coming. I wonder if I can butter him down. I shouldn't have expected either truth or honor or fair dealing from you, knowing you as I do. But foolishly, I trusted you. I don't know what you mean. I think you do. At any rate, you look very guilty. As I was riding along Ivy Street a while ago on my way to call on you, who should hail me from behind a hedge but Mrs. Ashley Wilkes? Of course, I stopped and chatted with her.
Indeed?
Yes. We had an enjoyable talk. She told me she had always wanted to let me know how brave she thought I was to have struck a blow for the Confederacy, even at the 11th hour.
Oh, fiddly-dee! Mellie's a fool. She might have died that night because you acted so heroic.
I imagine she would have thought her life given in a good cause. And when I asked her what she was doing in Atlanta, she looked quite surprised at my ignorance, and told me that they were living here now, and that you had been kind enough to make Mr. Wilkes a partner in your mill.
Well, what of it? Questioned Scarlet shortly.
When I lent you the money to buy that mill, I made one stipulation to which you agreed, and that was that it should not go to the support of Ashley Wilkes.
You are being very offensive. I paid you back your money, and I own the mill, and what I do with it is my own business.
Would you mind telling me how you made the money to pay back my loan?
I made it selling lumber, of course.
You made it with the money I lent you to give you your start. That's what you mean. My money is being used to support Ashley.
You are a woman quite without honor. And if you hadn't repaid my loan, I'd take great pleasure in calling it in now, and selling you out at public auction if you couldn't pay.
He spoke lightly, but there was anger flickering in his eyes.
Scarlet hastily carried the warfare into the enemy's territory. Why do you hate Ashley so much? I believe you're jealous of him.
After she'd spoken, she could have bitten her tongue. For he threw back his head and laughed until she went red with mortification. Add conceit to dishonor, he said. You'll never get over being the belle of the county, will you? You always think you're the cutest little trick in shoe leather, and that every man you meet is expiring for love of you.
I don't either, she cried hotly. But I just can't see why you hate Ashley so much, and that's the only explanation I can think of.
Well, think something else, pretty charmer, for that's the wrong explanation. And as for hating Ashley, I don't hate him any more than I like him. In fact, my only emotion toward him and his kind is pity.
Pity?
Yes, and a little contempt. Now swell up like a gobbler and tell me that he's worth 1,000 blackguards like me, and that I shouldn't dare be so presumptuous as to feel either pity or contempt for him. And when you finish swelling, I'll tell you what I mean, if you're interested.
Well, I'm not.
I shall tell you just the same. For I can't bear for you to go on nursing your pleasant delusion of my jealousy. I pity him because he ought to be dead and he isn't. and I have contempt for him because he doesn't know what to do with himself now that his world is gone." There was something familiar in the idea he expressed. She had a confused memory of having heard similar words, but she couldn't remember when and where. She didn't think very hard about it, for her anger was hot. "If you had your way, all the decent men in the South would be dead."
"And if they had their way, I think Ashley's kind would prefer to be dead. Dead with neat stones above them saying, 'Here lies a soldier of the Confederacy, dead for the Southland,' or 'Dulce et decorum est,' or any of the other popular epitaphs."
"I don't see why."
"You never see anything that isn't written in letters a foot high and then shoved under your nose, do you? If they were dead, their troubles would be over. There'd be no problems to face, problems that had no solutions. Moreover, their families would be proud of them through countless generations, and I've heard the dead are happy. Do you suppose Ashley Wilkes is happy?"
"Why, of course," she began.
And then she remembered the look in Ashley's eyes recently, and stopped. "Is he happy? Or Hugh Elsing? Or Dr. Meade? Any more than my father and your father were happy?"
"Well, perhaps not as happy as they might be, because they've all lost their money."
He laughed. "It isn't losing their money, my pet. I tell you, it's losing their world, the world they were raised in. They're like fish out of water or cats with wings. They were raised to be certain persons, to do certain things, to occupy certain niches. And those persons and things and niches disappeared forever when General Lee arrived at Appomattox."
"Oh, Scarlet, don't look so stupid.
What is there for Ashley Wilkes to do? Now that his home is gone and his plantation taken up for taxes, and fine gentlemen are going 20 for a penny, can he work with his head or his hands? I'll bet you've lost money hand over fist since he took over that mill."
"I have not."
"How nice. May I look over your books some Sunday evening when you're at leisure?"
"You can go to the devil, and not at your leisure. You can go now, for all I care."
"My pet, I've been to the devil, and he's a very dull fella. I won't go there again, even for you. You took my money when you needed it desperately, and you used it. We had an agreement as to how it should be used, and you have broken that agreement. Just remember, my precious little cheat, the time will come when you will want to borrow more money from me. You want me to bank you at some incredibly low interest so you can buy more mills and more mules and build more saloons, and you can whistle for the money."
"When I need money, I'll borrow it from the bank, thank you," she said coldly.
But her breast was heaving with rage.
"Will you?
Try to do it. I own plenty of stock in the bank."
"You do?"
"Yes, I'm interested in some honest enterprises."
"There are other banks."
"Plenty of them. And if I can manage it, you'll play hell getting a cent from any of them. You can go to the carpetbag usurers if you want money."
"I'll go to them with pleasure."
"You go, but with little pleasure, when you learn of their rates of interest. My pretty, there are penalties in the business world for crooked dealing. You should have played straight with me."
"You're a fine man, aren't you? So rich and powerful, yet picking on people who are down like Ashley and me."
"Don't put yourself in his class. You aren't down. Nothing will down you." "But he is down. And he'll stay there unless there's some energetic person behind him, guiding and protecting him as long as he lives. I'm of no mind to have my money used for the benefit of such a person."
"You didn't mind helping me, and I was down, and..."
"You were a good risk, my dear, an interesting risk."
"Why?"
"Because you didn't plump yourself down on your male relatives and sob for the old days. You got out and hustled. And now your fortunes are firmly planted on money stolen from a dead man's wallet and money stolen from the Confederacy. You've got murder to your credit, and husband stealing, attempted fornication, lying and sharp dealing, and any amount of chicanery that won't bear close inspection. Admirable things, all of them.
They show you to be a person of energy and determination and a good money risk. It's entertaining, helping people who help themselves. I'd lend $10,000 without even a note to that old Roman matron, Mrs. Merriweather. She started with a basket of pies, and look at her now. A bakery employing half a dozen people, old Grandpa happy with his delivery wagon, and that lazy little Creole, Renee, working hard and liking it. Or that poor devil, Tommy Welburn, who does two men's work with half a man's body and does it well. Well, I won't go on and bore you.
You do bore me. You bore me to distraction, said Scarlet coldly, hoping to annoy him and divert him from the ever-unfortunate subject of Ashley. But he only laughed shortly and refused to take up the gauntlet. People like them are worth helping.
But Ashley Wilkes? Bah!
His breed is of no use or value in an upside-down world like ours. Whenever the world upends, his kind is the first to perish.
And why not? They don't deserve to survive because they won't fight. Don't know how to fight.
This isn't the first time the world's been upside down, and it won't be the last. It's happened before, and it'll happen again, and when it does happen, everyone loses everything, and everyone is equal. And then they'll all start again, at taw, with nothing at all.
That is, nothing except the cunning of the brains and strength of the hands. But some people like Ashley have neither cunning nor strength, or having them, scruple to use them. And so they go under. And they should go under. It's a natural law, and the world is better off without them. But there are always a hardy few who come through, and given time, they're right back where they were before the world turned over.
You've been poor. You just said that your father turned you out without a penny, said Scarlet, furious. I should think you'd understand and sympathize with Ashley.
I do understand, said Rhett. But I'm damned if I sympathize. After the surrender, Ashley had much more than I had when I was thrown out. At least, he had friends who took him in, whereas I was Ishmael.
But what has Ashley done with himself? If you're comparing him with yourself, you conceited thing, why,